says finalization of the Vienna talks and the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides of the negotiations. The European Union threatens the UK with legal action if London does not fall in line with its obligations on Northern Ireland under the Brexit agreement. And Israeli bulldozers backed by troops demolish a Palestinian school under construction northeast of occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran says the finalization of any agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides involved in the talks over the accord. The foreign ministry spokesman said that all sides of the talks have acknowledged progress in the negotiations. However, Said Khatibzadeh added important issues have remained that need to be decided on by the other parties, especially the U.S. He said that Tehran's main policy is the removal of sanctions and added that policy will remain unchanged under the new Iranian government. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal began talks to revive it in April, 3 years after the U.S. left the accord. The German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas has said that a deal to save the accord can be reached in the coming weeks. Political analyst Tim Anderson says that Europe has done little to preserve the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and has been too weak to stand up to Washington's stubbornness.
The Europeans have done little to try and maintain this agreement. They've been too weak to stand up against the Trump administration when it reneged on the deal. And from the Iranian side, I mean, I know certainly the current administration would like to see an outcome there, and perhaps they're talking positively about it, but I don't think they're going to give in to their position, which is a strong moral position that the U.S. has to show some real dropping of sanctions. And so I don't really think that the Iranian side is going to make any concessions, and I don't think that the Washington side is capable of doing it. But in terms of returning to the 2015 agreement, I just don't think it's going to happen. I think there may be some other accommodation beyond the 2015 deal, but I think returning to that is virtually impossible in these circumstances. However, it might be that the Biden administration is able to start talking to Iran on a different basis and perhaps remove some of the sanctions there. Remember, there are a number of sanctions that the U.S. Really, they shouldn't be called sanctions. They're unilateral coercive measures. They're illegal, basically. But I think that the Biden administration might try and soften some of those as some sort of concession to keep a dialogue of goodwill going with Tehran. But I don't look for much more than that.
Iran and Syria have called for closer cooperation on all fronts. The call was made during a phone conversation between Iranian President-elect Ebrahim Raisi and the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They expressed both countries' determination to keep working together closely in different areas. They also urged continued consultations and coordination on issues of mutual interest. The Syrian President congratulated Raisi on his victory in the June 18th presidential election in Iran. Assad wished him luck with plans to boost national progress and to secure more accomplishments in various areas. The European Union has threatened further legal action against Britain over the Northern Ireland issue. The European Commissioner said that Brussels will step up legal proceedings if London fails to take satisfactory steps to remedy measures that it took in March. Markus Sefcovic accused London of acting against the spirit of joint action and violating what the two sides had agreed on. As part of the Brexit agreement, the two sides have signed up to the Northern Ireland Protocol. The protocol helps prevent checks along the border between Northern Ireland and the UK and the Republic of Ireland in the EU. But in March, the UK unilaterally extended a grace period where trade rules did not apply. Ireland slams London's approach to the Brexit deal and its failure to acknowledge concessions given on the Northern Ireland Protocol agreed between the UK and the EU. Earlier, we discussed the issue in detail with the guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
The Irish Foreign Minister has hit out at British officials over provocative comments on a Brexit trade agreement known as Northern Ireland Protocol. Simon Coveney says that the EU interprets the UK's behavior as showing no concession and instead trying to dismantle the protocol. He reacted to a recently published article by Britain's Brexit Minister David Frost and London's Northern Ireland Secretary Branson Lewis. The article says that the EU's recent measures on the implementation of the protocol address a tiny part of problems accusing the EU of lurching from crisis to crisis. Last week, Brussels announced a number of solutions to ease the implementation of Northern Ireland Protocol, including an extension on chilled meat trade. The protocol is part of post-Brexit efforts to ease trade between Northern Ireland, the UK, and the Republic of Ireland in the EU. Okay, EU and UK, so we have one person from the UK and one from somewhere in the EU. We have Said Kuruza in London joining us, and also Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels. Starting with Said, hopefully you're safe from this coronavirus thing. And Said, what's the catch? I mean, because this is some kind of arrangement after the UK's divorce from the from the EU, and now we have this protocol to facilitate things, but it looks like that it's not doing anything like that.
Good to be with you, Behrouz. You're right. This is, you know, the UK playing fast and loose with the law. The Northern Ireland Protocol, as part of the withdrawal agreement signed at the beginning of this year to avoid a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, an EU member, to facilitate trade. And a lot has happened since then. The Europeans are saying, look, if you didn't like the protocol, then you shouldn't have signed it. To which the UK is saying, as you said earlier, that, look, at the time when we signed on to the protocol, we thought it was going to work. Now we look at the realities on the ground, and we think that it's not really working the way it should, and so it needs revamping. It has accused the Europeans of taking, quote, a theological approach that is frozen in time and does not address the realities on the ground. The Northern Ireland Protocol was aimed at, as I said, avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Instead, they said, you know what, any goods coming into Northern Ireland will have to, from England, from Wales, from Scotland, will have to be checked on Northern Irish borders. That has led to what the unionists / loyalists are saying, the Protestants, saying, you know what, you're effectively creating a border in the Irish Sea, and we don't want that. So what this is doing is imperiling, putting in danger the Good Friday Agreement that put an end to 30 years of the troubles that lasted from the 1960s and to 1990s between the Protestants and the Catholics, the Protestants who one wished to be part of the UK and the Republicans who wished to reunite with the Republic of Ireland. So yes, it was aimed at facilitating trade, making things easy, but it looks like it'll be sometime before that happens. Both sides are calling for negotiation and engagement, but when you look at the UK's behavior, it has taken some unilateral action recently, for example, in extending the grace period up until October. Of course, they agreed on Wednesday to extend that till the end of September, meaning that that Northern Ireland will continue to act according to EU law. But beyond that, they will have to come up with a solution that will keep all the parties involved happy. So, it was aimed at facilitating things, but it looks like it's causing more trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's ask Jerome the way the EU perspective and the way that Brussels looked at this, because last week they offered some kind of solutions, you know, to ease things out. But Jerome, tell us about those solutions and if we could expect them to work.
Yes, Said, Behrouz, well, as Said said, you know, obviously the EU is saying, look, you signed up to this agreement, this Northern Ireland Protocol, but, you know, they're actually going back further than that. They're saying, look, David Cameron allowed for the referendum for Brexit. The people voted, albeit by a small majority, in favour of leaving. And so actually they believe there's a greater onus on the UK side to find solutions. This is an extension that you, when you mention about the elements of this, it's basically a relaxation or an extension of the grace period so that we can have easy trade between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland. But it's a temporary solution. And of course, potentially, if things break down further and we get a further deterioration in relations, there could be an all-out trade war between the EU and the UK, and the potential for the breakdown of the peace process in Northern Ireland. That's the worst-case scenario. But the EU is saying, look, you voted for Brexit. Brexit is more or less your problem. We have an onus to protect the interests of Ireland, because Ireland is still in the EU. But ultimately, you left the EU. So therefore, there's a greater responsibility on you to preserve the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, because that's enshrined in international law. The British government signed that. The Irish government signed that. And so there's an onus there on London to try and preserve that agreement. And there's a feeling here, there's complete lack of trust from the EU side in terms of Boris Johnson's government. And, you know, they see him as very arrogant. They realise that he has a good majority in the House of Commons, so he's got a lot of power there. I mean, Theresa May's government was being propped up by members of the DUP from Northern Ireland, so that they actually felt they had a greater say in the whole system. And in fact, they were able to scupper Theresa May's deal that she had with the EU, because they didn't like this so-called border in the Irish Sea. They don't want anything that differentiates Northern Ireland with the rest of the UK. They consider themselves British. But of course, they don't have that say anymore, because Boris Johnson has this majority. So, you know, there's a feeling here from the EU side that just the British government cannot be trusted, and anything that is agreed is not actually worth the paper it's written on.
Okay, so the blame game is going on, before the divorce, after the divorce. Okay, thank you very much for that. We had Saeed Purez, our journalist in London, also Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, with our contribution. And that's it for this news review.
Welcome back. Israeli forces have demolished yet another Palestinian structure in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The structure was a school under construction in Dahiyat al-Salam neighborhood. The video posted by Palestinian media shows Israeli troops and excavators entering the district for flattening the building. The demolition is the latest in Israel's long-running campaign of destroying Palestinian homes and buildings in occupied territories. Israel usually claims the structures lack construction permits, but Palestinians say that the demolitions are in line with Israel's land grab policy as the regime expands its settlements on occupied land. Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Lebanon's Hezbollah leader Saeed Hassan Nasrallah describes resistance media as partners in all victories achieved so far against oppressors. He also praises the media for breaking the U.S. hegemony in the region. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Said Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law. And this is why, on the other side, it's very legal for the Palestinians to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayyid Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Firefighters are battling nearly 200 wildfires raging in western Canada amid an unprecedented heat wave. Officials say that two-thirds of the fires have gone out of control in the Pacific province of British Columbia. Dozens of personnel have arrived from across Canada to help contain roaring flames. The wildfires have prompted evacuations in several towns, including Lytton. A blaze hit the town last week, raising it to the ground. Temperatures have set records in different parts of British Columbia, with the mercury reaching 50 degrees Celsius. The heat wave has killed hundreds of people in Canada over the past 2 weeks. India's COVID-19 deaths relative to infections have hit a record high in June, after cases peaked in early May. Official data show that the case fatality rate jumped to 3% in June from 1.26 in October. That means that deaths are not going down at the same rate that reported infections do. Experts have blamed that on the more contagious and dangerous Delta variant. Daily cases have fallen fast since a peak in May when India faced a second wave of the disease. The peak saw daily infections at above 400,000, but now they are below 100,000. Experts say in order for the daily deaths to decrease quickly, India needs to put restrictions. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. The people's participation makes the Islamic Republic strong in the real sense of the word. Well, those who speak fallaciously about the elections, and you can see that in some of the statements they make in the newspapers and in the internet, with recourse to various false statements when talking about the elections to discourage people from participating in the elections, they truly strive to weaken the system. The foreign enemies who are also opposed to the elections strive to weaken the system. They know that if the people's participation decreases and the country is weakened, they can bring insecurity to the country, expose it to the terrorism, and turn the country into a parade ground for terrorists. These things happen when the country and the people's support of it are weakened. Of course, they do not say this explicitly, but we hear different words about this in their statements, and we can see that they strive to do this. They want the people's participation to be less so that the system will be weakened and so that they can throw the country into disorder to be able to interfere and to turn the country into a parade ground for their mercenaries. One can see this. Another point is that if people's participation decreases, the enemy's pressures will increase in response. This means that these two have a reverse relationship in the true sense of the word. If public support decreases in the country, we will see the enemies applying increasing pressures in response. If we want the enemy's pressures, economic pressures such as the sanctions and the like, to decrease or ease up, the solution is to increase people's participation, and this public support should be shown to the enemy. Another point that is also important is about the candidate who will be elected as president on Friday. If the new president is elected by a significant majority of the votes, he will have firm support, he will be a strong, powerful president, and he can carry out great tasks. Our country, thank God, has many capabilities. There are many facilities and opportunities in our country. Using these opportunities requires sturdy, active, hardworking, untiring, strong people. The president gains this strength, besides the personal side, primarily and mainly from public support. If people's participation reaches a desirable minimal limit, and God willing, the president is elected with a large number of votes, this will give him the strength to use these capacities in the right way.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
the United States envoy to the U.S.-led anti-Daesh coalition has warned of a possible resurgence of the Takfiri terrorists in Iraq and Syria due to worsening poverty and inequity there. But what is the root cause of the instability and poverty afflicting Baghdad and Damascus? 2 years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took lives of over 1 million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos resulted from the U.S. invasion eventually gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. 3 years after, the Takfiri group captured nearly one-third of Iraq's territory. However, Baghdad finally declared victory over the terrorists in December 2017. The victory was owed to the bravery of commanders Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis that played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists. However, in a criminal and terrorist act, the U.S. killed these two figures in January 2020. That blatantly contradicts Washington's concern about the resurgence of Daesh. Following the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, anti-US sentiments escalated in Iraq. US bases in the country have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. That later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the US has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the US and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The US has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. While the US claims it cares about Syrian civilians, it has imposed crippling economic sanctions on Syria that prevent the country from rebuilding after a decade of war.
It's really hard to be really clear about what's the motivation here, because it could just be stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity in U.S. foreign policy, pig-headedness. The CIA, when people say, why do you keep invading and destroying countries when it doesn't work, when it doesn't help you? And the answer that the CIA gives is, it's what we do. It's what we do. It's just that's the way we function. It's almost like it's an instinct to invade, to create chaos. So that's one possibility. Another one that's related to this is could just be sour grapes. It could be spoil sport, that the U.S. sees that these countries want to become independent, want to develop independently of the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple the government of President Bashar Assad. After failing to do so through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government implemented additional sanctions in Syria through a law known as the CSAR Act. The crippling sanctions under the CSAR Act specifically target energy and construction sectors to prevent Syria from rebuilding after a decade of war. The CSAR Act enabled Washington to sanction any person involved in reconstruction efforts in government-controlled parts of Syria. The correlation between U.S. economic sanctions and the crisis in Syria is clear. Syria's currency has plummeted and prices for basic goods have soared as a result of the sanctions. According to the UN, 60% of Syrians lack access to sufficient food. Besides the economic embargo, the U.S. has also occupied oil fields in Syria's northeast, depriving Damascus of a vital resource. Moreover, the UN has warned that U.S. sanctions have hampered humanitarian aid deliveries in Syria.
Yes, they do want a certain amount of instability and chaos wherever their own interests are threatened. So Syria, it was clearly the strongest anti-imperialist, anti-American force, anti-Israel force in the Middle East.
Washington alerts that Daesh terrorists might start regaining territory in Iraq and Syria as a result of poverty and instability there. That's while the U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socioeconomic conditions there. Besides sanctions, U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh never would have formed.
The crisis in Yemen is deepening as fresh fierce clashes between Yemeni forces and Saudi-led militants have erupted in Ma'arib. The clashes happened between Yemeni forces and Allied Popular Committees fighters and the rival forces who are loyal to former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. Local sources say the Yemeni troops and Allied Popular Committee fighters mounted intensive attacks from the north, south, and west to push the Saudi mercenaries out of the region. Saudi warplanes are reported to have conducted more than a dozen strikes on residential areas across the region.
Well, it clearly shows that the Ansarallah movement cannot be defeated. And that's what's so important, that Saudi Arabia, with all of its vast military equipment and years of U.S. support, military aid, jet aircraft, naval blockades, have failed to defeat the Ansarallah movement. And as a matter of fact, have suffered one defeat after another.
Over the past few weeks, Ma'arib has been the scene of large-scale operations by Yemeni troops and their allied forces. They're pushing against Saudi-sponsored pro-Hadi militants. Yemeni forces are closing in on Ma'arib, the last stronghold of pro-Hadi forces in northern Yemen. The loss of the strategic region would mean the defeat of the Saudi-backed regime. Yemeni forces had earlier liberated several strategic heights in the northwest of the province after intense fighting. Analysts believe control of the oil-rich region of Ma'arib would strengthen the bargaining position of Yemeni forces and peace talks. The fierce clashes come amid fresh attempts to bring an end to what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is desperate to find a face-saving way out of its disastrous bombing campaign in Yemen. It is believed that the Saudi regime has failed miserably in Yemen, as its foreign interventions have failed to produce desirable results for the kingdom.
Clearly, it shows that Saudi Arabia could not prevail through military measures. So now they are talking about, let's have a peace agreement. But they're asking for many things that they could not win on the battlefield. So whether they will gain it in peace talks, that's highly unlikely.
The new administration in Washington has pushed for fresh attempts to bring the war to an end. But Yemeni forces have dismissed the so-called peace initiatives presented by the U.S. to end the war in the country, saying such plans are not favorable since they fail to include the Yemeni nation's demands, including lifting the siege on the port city of Aden.
The UN is acting in favor of major powers and exhibits clear bias. The aggressor countries are committing the most heinous crimes against Yemeni children, and yet they were not included in the list. The UN decision is disconnected from realities and does not rely on independent accounts.
Any peace agreement must be based on ending the siege, the closing of the ports, and the distribution of food to the population of Yemen, who've been held hostage by Saudi Arabia and also by the U.S. through this whole process.
Ansarallah movement says no just solution to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been worked out yet. The Yemenis say the aggressors have to end all their attacks against Yemen, take out all their forces, end an all-out siege that they have been imposing on the Arab country, including the port city of Aden, and compensate the victims before entering any peace process.
Well, they certainly have no desirable result. They first announced that this would be a war over in a matter of weeks and then months, and it has dragged on for more than 6 years. So it's a complete disaster in the eyes of the entire region. It does show the weakness of this corrupt regime that is unable to carry on a war against a country far less technologically, doesn't have the means, doesn't have the military forces, and yet it has a mobilization of the people. And that is what is decisive again and again, as we're finding in every country.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies have been engaged in a devastating war in the country that began in March 2015. They were backed by the U.S. and other Western powers. The aggressors were trying to reinstall Yemen's former president Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, a staunch ally of Riyadh, to crush the Ansarallah movement. The Saudi war has failed to achieve its goals, but pushed Yemen to the brink of a humanitarian crisis. Saudi officials claimed that the war would last only a few weeks.
These are the last German soldiers to withdraw from Afghanistan. Over the last couple of years, Germany had the second largest contingent of troops after the United States. The German defense minister says that After nearly 20 years of deployment, the last soldiers left Afghanistan. Annegret Kramp Karen Bauer added that this is the end of a historic chapter of an intensive mission. 59 German soldiers died in Afghanistan. 35 of them had been killed in combat or as a result of militant attack, making it Germany's deadliest military mission since World War II. Looking back, the minister vowed to discuss where it went wrong and what Berlin has learned.
We've not only accomplished nothing, we have grievously damaged Afghan society over the last 20 years of bombing and so on and so forth. There was never a political coalition in Afghanistan to support the United States. Even less so than in Vietnam, in my opinion.
Because of the security problems in Afghanistan and the increasing levels of violence, the German military kept the details of its withdrawal vague. Berlin sent its forces in the wake of the 9/11 attacks on the US in 2001. Meanwhile, British media reports suggest the majority of British troops have quietly withdrawn from Afghanistan. Again, Britain withdrawing its forces, if confirmed, would have been shrouded in secrecy. According to the latest UN report, US-led forces, in particular Germany and Italy and the UK, are leaving Afghanistan while the country remains in bad shape. Violence is on the rise and Afghans are facing multiple crises, including rising poverty, which could increase from 50% to 70%. These all suggest that over two decades of foreign military presence has failed to bring peace to Afghanistan. In mid-April, US President Joe Biden and NATO announced they would pull out the roughly 10,000 foreign troops still in Afghanistan at the time by September 11, marking the 20th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York that sparked the invasion of the country itself. The mission had been aimed at toppling the then-ruling Taliban government. 20 years later, Washington has been negotiating with the militant group itself on the best way to withdraw. During those 20 years, Afghans have witnessed a spiral of violence and terror.
It's obvious that this 20 years here hasn't benefited the Afghans in any way. Here we are with 2,500 troops left, more or less, who knows, you know, thousands of contractors, and several different things have come out in the newspaper in the last week. One, in spite of all this alleged training and so on and so forth, the only thing that is flyable in Afghanistan right now over the next few weeks are the Russian-made helicopters.
Meanwhile, U.S. officials speaking to CNN on condition of anonymity indicated that America itself may complete its withdrawal within days. One official says the Pentagon is considering keeping at least 650 troops in the country to safeguard the American embassy and Kabul airport. This comes as violence has sharply increased between Taliban militants and government forces since the U.S. missed a May withdrawal deadline agreed between the militants group and the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump. According to the Pentagon, the Taliban are now estimated to be in control of 81 districts out of the country's 419. There are fears of a looming civil war as the warring sides struggle to clinch a possible power-sharing peace deal during intra-Afghan negotiations.
The United States says it carried out deadly airstrikes on the positions of Iraq Popular Mobilization units on both sides of the border with Syria on Sunday. Washington claimed their strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The attack drew angry reactions from Iraq and Syria. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Syria, for its part, also condemned in strongest terms the U.S. flagrant oppression in the Syrian-Iraqi border region, describing it as a blatant violation of the sanctity of the Syrian and Iraqi territories.
We have to understand instability is the goal. This is when a war cannot necessarily be won, the invader, the attacker, the aggressor can sort of make the next best thing in their interest, and that is for the war to be constant, the market to be permanent, never ending, the chaos to rule supreme, the strategy of chaos, which is that you destabilize a region to such an extent that they will have no choice but to accept your continued presence. This is something that we've seen in Afghanistan as well. How many times has NATO decided and said and promised that they were going to pull back? Now it looks like the Americans are finally going to pull back, but it is really a wait-and-see sort of thing.
Syria says the latest U.S. attack once again showed the recklessness of Washington's policies and the need for Washington to withdraw its aggressor forces from the region. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country, but the U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order.
Again, fortunately, this sort of psychological operation hasn't exactly succeeded, because despite everything, the Iraqis definitely, and the Syrians as well, they still don't want U.S. boots on the ground. They want all Americans out. Doesn't matter what the alternative is. They don't want these imperialist invaders to keep occupying their land. But this is what the Americans keep on trying, and this is exactly why they make up these stupid excuses with which to attack and destroy not the terrorists, but the people who fight against the terrorists, because they try to make it almost in an Orwellian way. They try to switch around the definitions and blame the people who are defending their country for terrorism, while they start to portray the terrorists as quote-unquote freedom fighters, or, you know, people who are moderate rebels fight for democracy like they did in Syria.
The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. Apart from the United States, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. You are joining us with the program Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we'll be discussing problems that parents usually have regarding Islamic upbringing. We have our guest, Brother Miqdad, over here, who is qualified and the right person to talk about this topic. Welcome, Brother Miqdad, to our show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's a great pleasure. I think we are talking about parental upbringing, Islamic, that is. And you did mention confidence in the child, and I think we dealt with two factors that might potentially lead to or show us that the child is unconfident, right?
So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We were looking at the different signs that might be seen in a child with confidence or a child with lack of confidence. Adding to those signs, let's talk about a couple more.
You said that these are not 100% signs that he's not confident. They might be signs that he's unconfident.
That's correct, yes. I said that some of these signs depend on certain factors. One of them could be confidence, but there are other factors that could be involved as well.
Which you did mention in the previous episode.
Exactly. So we should be careful in how we deal with these signs. But nonetheless, these signs are important. We can keep an eye on our children, depending and putting them together, basically, to see how we can see if a child is really lacking in self-confidence or is other skills that are necessary to teach the child, and if in either case, how do we move on and increasing or improving the self-confidence of a child. Another sign, or another, you can say, manifestation of confidence in a child is being beneficial to others, helping others, solving people's problems. A child with confidence will actually count himself as beneficial, feel like I'm useful over here, feels useful. And because of feeling useful, will be there to help out his peers. So when a child sees another child, for example, fallen down or having hurt themselves or having lost something and are looking for something, in those cases, a child with confidence will feel that I can be helpful over here. And they would go and assist the child in whatever way they can. So being a beneficial member of society and feeling that they can be helpful, or even at times solving problems. For example, if you have two children that are fighting in the playground or two children that are bickering about something, there's a fight going on, children with confidence would step in and would try and solve a problem. They would put them aside and say, okay, let's see what the problem is.
Yeah.
Children with lack of confidence, they wouldn't get involved, too scared to get involved over here.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask. That the points that you're mentioning, is it easy to say that the quite opposite of whatever you're saying could be a sign of lack of confidence?
It could be, yes, that's correct. Yeah. So in this case, for instance, a child with lack of confidence, when he sees two children are fighting over something, then they would not get involved. Let them fight. It's none of my business. I can't be useful in any case. What will I do if they can't themselves out? I won't be able to do anything. They don't count themselves as problem solvers, as able to help the situation, or strong enough to be able to fix a problem, basically. Same thing at home, for example. Something's leaking, a tap is leaking, something's broken, there's something missing in the house. Children with confidence would come up and say, okay, I'll fix it. I'll be able to turn this into something that's quite useful.
They're really overconfident at times.
Yes. Children with lack of confidence be like, no, if I touch it, it'll get worse. If I try to solve it, I'll make it even worse. I won't be able to help the situation. So these kind of children don't get involved into fixing problems, fixing issues, and they don't count themselves as beneficial in any way.
Right, so they are problem solvers, children who are confident, and they see themselves as being useful to people around us, themselves. Please stay tuned. We'll return after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have
two boys. One is 5 year old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back. We're with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about signs of confidence and lack of confidence. And we talked about the skills, problem solving, and putting themselves out as helpers.
Another thing that children with confidence will be able to do is taking telling off, or taking advice, or even taking sometimes negative criticism, right? So children
who... What do you mean, like taking, like positively?
Positively and be able to bear it. So sometimes, obviously, children can get up to mischief, they can do things that go wrong, they can get themselves in trouble, basically, anyway, whatever they've done in action. Now, parents come in and say, why did you do this? This was wrong. You shouldn't have done this. Look what happened. Sometimes anger comes in, sometimes in a very strong tone. Children with confidence would, if it's their parents, would understand the situation, okay? And they would obviously feel bad, feel sad perhaps, go to their room. But this feeling won't last very long, right? Because at the end of the day, they know that my mom and my dad love me, okay? This is something that bad that I did, but it doesn't make any difference in terms of our relationship with our parents.
Okay. So you are strictly looking at it from the child's perspective, right? Because there are things that parents have to do for that child to be able to think like that.
So we'll talk about those things when we talk about how to increase self-confidence.
Right.
But in the case of the child over here, a child with self-confidence would actually overcome the situation very quickly, right? As opposed to children who don't have confidence. So let me talk about that. It'll become perhaps more clear. Children who don't have confidence will feel extremely bad, okay? Will feel heartbroken. Would feel unable to bear the situation, and they would cry a lot, for instance, or would feel that everything's over, would feel really bad about themselves, would actually be very difficult to turn this over, turn the page, basically, and it will take a longer period of time. And they would actually then lead on to thinking about other things. For example, they would doubt their own ability from then on.
Right. I was about to ask that. Are they going to think negatively about themselves or about their parents?
They would take both of them. They would take negatively their own ability, and they would add this as a failure to the other failures that they've had and count themselves as complete failure. And they would also doubt their relationship with their parents, that I've failed my parents.
Well, they do not love me enough.
They don't love me enough anymore, or I'm such a bad person that they would kick me out, for example. They would have these very negative feelings in terms of relationship with others.
Interesting. About you themselves. See kids who try to leave the house because they're like, okay, I'm not worth anything anymore, and just run away.
Exactly. And so this all comes from a lack of worth for themselves, a lack of self-esteem, a lack of confidence in themselves. On the other side now, children with confidence, they would just put it aside very quickly. Okay, this happened, done and deal, let's move on. Life goes on, basically. They know my dad and my mom all loves me. It's nothing to do with my abilities or my thing. It was just a one-time thing that something went wrong. It went wrong. Sometimes they would even actually not blame themselves. They would blame actually the thing itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's the pipe that wasn't working very well. That's why the whole house is flooded right now. I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Basically, they have. They don't count it as a failure on their part. It's a situation that this is what happened, and they see the reality and of the consequence, basically. And yes. These children would learn from their mistake, especially if parents do it in a very good way. They would learn from this experience. They would benefit from it in terms of a new skill might be gained or a new positive point.
But they would not keep that as a grudge kind of thing or like negatively for themselves. We'll return after another short break. Please stay tuned with this important topic.
Ya
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about factors and signs of confidence and lack of confidence. We're with Brother Miqdad, and please go on.
Another sign that perhaps might be often associated with confidence and lack of confidence is attention seeking. So children that don't have too much confidence, don't have too much self-esteem, would actually be attention seekers. They would do things for others to notice them. They
really? Who do not have confidence, they want more attention?
They want more attention. They do things to please others. I would go out of my way even more than I should, just so that I can please you, so that I can gain your attention.
Approval.
So I gain your approval, mm-hmm. basically. The reason is obvious. It's quite obvious. Children who don't have confidence in themselves, they feel that they should get their confidence from somewhere else.
Right.
It doesn't stem from within. It stems from outside. So if you say... If you praise a child with self-confidence, it will be best thing in the world. With confidence, it will be, kind of attitude. Because that's very nice, thank you. And life goes on, basically.
Yeah.
I didn't really need that kind of praise. You already obeyed, basically, before you even said it.
Yeah.
A child with lack of confidence would actually take this praise in a very exaggerated way. Right? It would mean the world to them. And if you hadn't said it, then it would be the worst thing ever. They actually thrive on people's comments.
That's their motivation, is it?
Exactly. They feel that others should others are giving me this energy to do things.
Yeah, and I would.
The more they praise
it.
Me, the more I'll do it, and the less they praise me, the less I feel I should be motivated to do it, because I don't feel this is worth anything, unless people tell me that this is worth it. And so, seeking attention being driven by other people's comments is a sign of lack of confidence. Whilst children with confidence, they do things based on what the goal that they have. They have an objective. They want to do something, however crazy it might be. But they're driven by the fact that I'm able to do it. If I want to do it, I'll do it. If I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it. Whatever drives me, basically.
Just the thought itself is enough for them. Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't necessarily have to be a very... rational or logical thought, or even a divine thought. It can sometimes be a very mischievous thought, or it can be something that's very crazy. But they're not driven by people's comments. They're not driven by what people would think of me, or what people would say of me, or how they would judge me based on this. Mm-hmm. I'm driven by something that I believe to be right, or something I believe to bring me pleasure and a lot of fun, and I'll go about and do this, however people think of me.
Right.
Yeah. Obviously, overconfidence might be dangerous over here, but the point is that they have.
Which is why they need supervision, of course. You know,
but at least the point over here is that it's a sign of saying that this child is actually confident. He believes that he's able to do things, believes that he's able to make decisions, believes that he has a skill and the worth to put it into action, into practice, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And don't necessarily need others to give him or her worth, basically.
Yeah. These things need to be channeled. So once you actually see them in the child, you can be at the mischievous thought, like the kid, that can be channeled in a positive way, and we can get positive outcomes in their lives. Thank you so much for being with us with another program of Islamic Upbringing. Please, dear listeners, send us your questions, suggestions, or comments at englishradio@irib.ir, and do visit our website, parstoday.com. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.